EWTN Global Catholic Radio presents John of the Cross, The Great Exchange. Insights into the writings of St. John of the Cross, founder of the Discalced Carmelite Order. Now here is your host, Father Thomas Dubay.
Welcome once again to The Great Exchange and its faithful herald, St. John of the Cross. I'm Father Thomas Dubay, Marist priest based in Washington, D.C. You may recall that we finished up last time with what we called, John calls, the touches, expressly dealing with the intimate, most intimate union with God on earth. There's nothing like it, as we indicated last time. Now, this week, we're going to take up expressly, after a little bit of a linking, we're going to take up expressly the subtitle of this series of lectures on St. John of the Cross. And the subtitle of our series, as you notice, is The Great Exchange. And it's going to be linked in our first few little comments here with what we did last week and then where we're going. Namely, the connection between the world in which we live, this planet Earth, and our daily lives, and the new creation to which we are called. Now, I want to recall what we finished up with last week, but I want to put it in contemporary terms, that remarkable contact, union, experience of God, the likes of which eye has not seen nor ear heard, as St. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians. Now, I wish to use here expressions such as those I've heard over the years in spiritual direction. I am not thinking of any individual person. I'm not quoting anybody verbatim, but I am giving you in little brief statements how people have put this. And it's another way of doing what we did last week, and it serves as this link to where we go from here. Here is the kind of thing people say today in our own world. I've heard them with my own ears. And these are sincere people. They're often very intelligent. They have a deep prayer life, completely honest, and they're living the gospel well. Here is what I've heard from them. I just knew it was He, and I can't explain how. Remember, beauty is indicator of truth. It's immediate evidence of truth, and God makes Himself known. You can't explain how it is, but you just know it for sure. I've heard that kind of thing often. I saw nothing. You see, it is not a vision. It's not a revelation. It's not extraordinary in that theological sense we explained in another episode. It's in the grace life. It's a normal development of communion with God. I saw nothing. It's no vision, but it's a real keen knowing and experience. It was utterly unexpected and out of my control to extend it. Which shows you that this is not self-induced. The person cannot start it. As Teresa brilliantly put it once, you cannot acquire the least speck of these deep experiences of God. And it's completely out of your control to extend it. Even the more delicate ones, the beginning ones, you can't begin them and you can't extend them. They're entirely given by God. And often, as this formulation put it, unexpected. It can happen while somebody's peeling carrots. It could happen teaching a class, although I don't know if it's quite that frequent that way. St. Philip Neri had that problem saying Mass. He could not speak at Mass sometimes because he would just overcome with this contact with the Lord. He would just have to suspend operations for an hour or two. Another formulation I have heard, all of a sudden, there was a burning love. I did nothing to get it. There were no reflections beforehand. It's not self-induced. It's not an emotion. It's way beyond an emotion. And it's a love experience, a burning love. That's one of these touches of a particular type. I can't forget the experience. It's indelible. Often it's indelible. If it's the kind of touch John was talking about in our segment last week, indeed, you don't forget about it. Another way it is put, time went by and I didn't know it. It could last for a while, And the person, when one kind of comes out of it, you don't lose consciousness or where you are, usually, and all that sort of thing. But it's a timeless kind of thing in that sense. And the person doesn't know how long it lasted, often. What delight. You can't imagine it. See, there's no delight on earth. No delight on earth at all that compares with this. Can't be imagined. That's what Paul is saying. Eye has not seen, nor ear heard. You can't even imagine what things God has in store for those who love Him. And then the last kind of thing I've heard, wow, what must heaven be like if He can do this on earth? Now, these are formulations that I've heard with my own ears just like this. I just summed them up in these few statements of what St. John of the Cross is talking about in those touches we dealt with last week. Now, our link. This brief summary of these profound experiences of God can serve as keys to where we go from here. The divine touches, these deep experiences of God, link what we have done in the course thus far, our series of lectures, and our next section, which we now take up in this segment, the Great Exchange. And the Great Exchange, of course, as the very name implies, indicates that there is a price to be paid for these experiences of God. And I'm going to go in great detail what that entails and why it is so utterly reasonable, not only reasonable, indispensable, given our human situation. We're not in heaven yet. We're working out our eternal destiny and salvation. And you will notice as we go on through the Great Exchange that actually it implies authenticity, that a person really is authentically living the gospel, is being transformed, not only in prayer life, very much there, of course, but also in the nitty-gritty of daily activities. And this is why you find this extraordinary holiness in the saints. Now we are ready for the Great Exchange, the subtitle of our series. Introductory ideas are a good way to begin. And I want to suggest to you several introductories even before we get to the question of the Great Exchange. And the first idea is that God never asks for mere negations. He's utterly positive. But because you and I live on planet Earth, because we are wounded, there are negations in the spiritual life. But He never asks just for that. For example, the Evangelical Council of Poverty, which monks and nuns take on, it's a council, it's not required of everybody. It involves a negation, of course, but it's not a mere negation. People want to be poor, in fact, frugal in lifestyle, because of many good things that come to them. When religious, for example, have a rule of silence, it's not merely a negation. And by the way, we all need some kind of silence, as Scripture itself indicates. We've got to stop making noise once in a while and gather our inner life together. But the point I wish to make at this moment is that while the Great Exchange implies negation, and we'll be spelling this out in detail, it's not merely a negation. It's in order to get something much better. Now, this deep experience of God, profound prayer life, to which, again, we are all called, does not happen out of the blue. It's not automatic like a soft drink machine. If you put the right coins into the Pepsi machine or the Coke machine, and if it's working properly, you've exchanged money and out pops the soft drink. And so also, while it's not automatic, we do not grow into this deep communion with the Lord simply by formulae. And this is one of the big differences between our contemplation, Christic contemplation, and Oriental. It's methods that they give you to get to a certain awareness. Ours is completely different. It's a communion that God Himself gives us. And it is not automatic for several reasons, one of which being that God is not to be manipulated by anybody's techniques. He's divine, three divine persons. And persons do not want to be manipulated. You don't, I don't, and certainly He's not going to be manipulated by anybody's techniques. So that's our first introductory idea, that God is not asking negations for their own sakes. It's always in view of positive, something positive, much better. That's why we call it a great exchange. Second introductory idea, exchanges are everywhere in human life. Not only in the spiritual life. People are naive who think that they can acquire a great degree of holiness and a deep prayer life simply by techniques. And that's the way it's usually taught in my experience. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. We've got to exchange everywhere in human life. For example, if you want a car, you will have to exchange money. And by the money implied work to get the money. You've got to have both of them somehow for the exchange to happen. If you want success in life, say success in the meaning of the term adequate livelihood, you're going to have to study. You're going to have to prepare yourself. You'll have to learn some skills. Those exchange again. If you want health, there has to be an exchange. Doesn't happen out of the blue. You need exercise, proper diet, and so on. It is true likewise in the New Testament. Not surprisingly at all. You cannot, said the Lord himself, serve God and mammon. There's only one end, one purpose in life, and that's God, and all the rest are means to him. But you can't seek two gods at one time, little idols, as I've been calling them in other segments of our series. Or as the Lord puts it in Matthew 16, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and suffer the loss of his soul? Again, an exchange is implied there. If you want your eternal ecstasy, which is a very good definition of heaven, then there's going to have to be exchange. Give up all self-centeredness. Our third introductory idea to this great exchange, negatives in life, therefore, are unavoidable. Any positive choice implies a negation. Can't be helped. For example, if a young woman has a number of young male friends and she's beginning to think which one might be the one that I would like for a husband, she's going to have to make an exchange in her mind first and then in reality. She can't marry two people at one time. And so there has to be an exchange. There has to be a negation. If I say yes to this one, it will have to be, sorry, but no, to the other one. It's just the way things are. If you have $15,000-$20,000 and you would like a new car, probably need one maybe, and you know also that your roof needs to be patched, it's leaking, you're going to have to choose one or the other, supposing you can't have them both at this time. And so the positive choice necessarily implies a negative to it. It was naive, therefore, for people to say two or three decades ago, it used to be the popular thing to say in religious circles, that, oh, I like the joy idea of the gospel and this freedom and so on, both of which are very valuable realities. But I don't like this negative humility, you know, and self-denial and obedience. I don't want those things. Those people were naive. Not only they did not understand the gospel, they don't even understand the human situation. Only God can be completely positive with no negations whatsoever. You and I necessarily must live with negations. That's part of our human situation until we get to the eternal ecstasy. That brings us to our fourth introductory idea. Namely, each one of us is choosing our eternal destiny in all the nitty-gritty choices of daily life. In our human relationships, in our worship, in earning a living, in recreating, whatever we're doing, listening to this program right now, and I giving the talk. You and I are all of us working out our destiny, so that if in my choices, if in your choices, we're choosing to be self-denying. We're choosing altruism. We're choosing to make self-sacrifices, to be obedient and pure, and use things not selfishly, not in a miserly fashion. and we deal well with one another. We refuse to quarrel. Even if somebody wants to quarrel about it, we're not going to quarrel. We'll discuss this amiably. But we're making our destiny. We are either becoming lovable people or we're becoming hateful people. In all of our nitty-gritty choices, we're doing it right now, you and I. We do it all the time. So that we're becoming more and more beautiful, more and more good, more and more transformed, as Paul puts it, from one glory to another, or we're getting worse and worse and worse. And unless we repent, if we've alienated ourselves from God, therefore really from one another, that unless there's a repentance, we are making an eternal disaster. So in that sense, and that's what we mean, we choose our heaven and our hell. We are finished with our introduction to the great exchange. We haven't even really defined it yet. We're going to take up the subject, which has several little traits to it. I'll tick off rapidly, not to be critical, but to realize that what we take up now is very seldom explained, and that's the first trait. And I don't say that to be negative. I say it because it underlines the importance of attending to what we're doing. Because it is not often explained, the great exchange is very much misunderstood. Again, I'm blaming nobody. If there's anybody to be blamed, it would be we who are supposed to proclaim the gospel do not proclaim this and explain it as we ought. This subject is also decidedly unpopular with the worldly world. Mostly, I should like to think, because they really don't know what it means and they don't understand why it is crucial, but nonetheless, it is not a popular subject. Next, this subject, the Great Exchange, is thought to be special to John of the Cross, implying that, well, other saints don't talk about it and other theologians don't, you see, and so it's kind of considered John's property. That is not so. It is completely in the New Testament, and it is taught by all the saints I know of. But John's great contribution is the detail with which he spells it out and explains it. He's just a master of this, as he is also of these deep prayer experiences with God. This subject is prominent in the New Testament, and we shall notice as we go along. And the last little trait I should like to tick off rapidly. This great exchange means very deeply a tremendous amount of sense. It makes sense in plain English. Once you understand it and where you're going and why all of it is so. I'm referring, therefore, to detachment and attachment. And that is what we're going to explain in considerable detail right now. I've said that the subject is usually misunderstood, most likely, principally because it is not explained adequately. And so we're going to explain here some of the terms that John uses. I want to mention them, and we will explain them as we go along. John will say, for example, in his works, we have to give up desires. Now, somebody just reading that without any explanation would say, I can't give up desires. I can't take a drink of water unless I want to desire the water. I won't eat a meal unless I desire to. That's impossible. What John means is what we shall be talking about, and we'll explain it. He has another term that I would just as soon not use today, but he does use it. I would translate it differently if I were translating him. He will say appetites. Now, for you and me, appetite means hunger before a meal. He's not talking about that. He's talking about the original Latin word, which appetitus, which means a desire, really. And what he's talking about with all of these things is what we're going to be distinguishing as attachments. And the correlative to attachment, detachment. And so we're going to be explaining John right along here. So, first of all, let me say what attachment here does not mean. Because many people do think that the three things I'm going to say are what the idea implies, and they think it's impossible, therefore. Attachments, as we use the term in this context, does not mean, number one, does not mean experiencing pleasure in things. pleasure in itself is good. God created it. He could have made a universe that's entirely bland, with no pleasure in it at all. He didn't. He made things delightful. And there are people who think that, say, because I like apple pie, I can't be detached from apple pie, because I like it so much. Experiencing pleasure is not an attachment to apple pie or to anything else. There's no doubt that there's a danger in it, that because it is pleasurable, therefore I will seek it for itself. A little idle, to use our terminology in the previous episodes. Yeah, that is bad news. Because there's only one God, pleasure is not to be an idol and to be worshipped. But it's not bad. So, detachment does not mean we give up all pleasures. Attachment is not, therefore, experiencing pleasure. Number two of what it is not. Feeling an attraction to something and someone, something beautiful. To feel that attraction, even to feel it strongly, is not an attachment. So if you look at an orchid, it's gorgeous. And of course I'm attracted to an orchid. A lovely face is attractive. And it's a normal response to be attracted to something beautiful and lovely. After all, it's a compliment to the artist that made the orchid and made the beautiful face. To be attracted to a charming personality, of course we should be attracted to all of these things and all the beauties that God has made. So the attraction is not an attachment. There is the danger, though, no fault of the attraction, no fault of the beautiful object, there's a danger of, again, making an idol out of the thing. And that's bad news, as we shall be explaining why it is bad news. So the mere attraction is not an attachment. Number three, possessing and using things are not attachments to them. Most of us have a watch on our wrist. I have one with the vow of poverty. I don't own it. I don't own anything. I don't even know this kind of decrepit condition. New Testament. Don't own anything, which I'm delighted not to own. That's great. It's a great freedom. But in any event, I use all kinds of things. This New Testament, this watch, and so on. And I have a little travel alarm. I have to take that along with me, too. So using clothes, food, drink, coat, house, watches, and whatever else, typewriter, computers, some people need a computer, no attachment there. Now, again, we have to watch that it doesn't become an idol, that we start making a little god out of the thing and bending our knee to it. Now we're ready for a definition of an attachment. I wish it would be said on Sunday morning enough times that people really understand it, and then I wish the other things that follow would also be said, and we'd have a lot easier path to holiness. An attachment. There are three parts to the definition. It's a clinging of the will to something created for its own sake. Notice, number one, it's a willed matter, a willed clinging, a willed desire. It's not simply feeling something. So, it's a clinging of my will to something created. It could be the apple pie. It could be vanity of various types. It could be laziness. It's not only material goods, but one clings to something created, in other words, something that is not God. That's the second element, for its own sake, which means making a little god out of it. Because everything God created is to bring us to Him in this eternal ecstasy of heaven and to help others to get to Him. That's why we got so beautiful and stunning a universe, to bring us to the source of all beauty, who made the whole thing. You can't have artwork without an artist, and anybody who thinks that happened by chance is I don't want to use too strong a word, mistaken, grievously mistaken. It's just like going to Michelangelo and looking at his, his pietà and say, well, that all happened by chance. You know, there was a big windstorm, cosmic windstorm for centuries, and it just kind of blew that marble to that kind of shape, which, of course, is absurd. Now, I won't go off into that. So that an attachment, therefore, is a willed reality, clinging, desiring something created for, secondly, for its own sake, a clinging of the will for its own sake, something created. Those are the three elements in it. Now, let's put that negatively in the terms of St. Paul. In 1 Corinthians 1:10, Paul said, whether you eat or drink, or do anything else, anything, do all for the glory of God. That says positively exactly what we're saying. So what we're saying is deeply biblical. I'm simply spelling it out in intelligible modern terminology. Clinging of the will to something created for its own sake. Paul says the same thing there. In Titus 2:12, we've got another expression which many people would assume just reading it without preparation that this has to be an exaggeration. Says Titus, God's grace has been revealed and taught us that what we have to do is to give up everything that does not lead to God and all our worldly ambitions. Now that makes perfect sense. It fits exactly what we have been saying, that if one really accepts that God is God, supreme destiny, unspeakable, then of course you use everything to bring yourself and others to Him. We'll continue at this point next week.
Join us again next week at this time for John of the Cross, The Great Exchange, on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio.